Our next case is Townsend v. Brooks Sports, Inc., case number 21-2143. Mr. Hampton?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, I see you have reserved, is it 6 minutes or 7 minutes of time for rebuttal?
I thought we said seven, but six is fine.
It's up to you.
Six.
6 minutes. Okay. All right, you may begin.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Steve Hampton for the appellant, Mr. Herbert Townsend. The 416 patent discloses a shoe with midsole components that enhance both cushioning and running speed. As Claim 1 recites, the midsole component is material consisting essentially of a dilatant compound that fills a cavity in the midsole. The 416 patent explains that the dilatant compound is soft and pliable under slow loading, and is elastic and bouncy under rapid loading, and those very different behaviors provide both enhanced cushioning and enhanced running speed. The board decided that Claim 1 was unpatentable on two obviousness grounds. For one ground, the board decided that it would have been obvious to replace the silicone bouncing putty in the midsole of the shoe disclosed by the Izumi reference with the recited material. For the other ground, the board decided that it would have been obvious to replace a fluid-containing cushioning device in the midsole of a shoe disclosed by the Rudy reference with body padding disclosed by the Plant reference. Both decisions are based on legal errors, including erroneous claim construction, failure to ascertain and consider differences between the claimed invention and the prior art, failure to consider obviousness of the invention as a whole, and failure to identify a motivation to combine or modify prior art. The board's decisions that Claim 1 is unpatentable over Izumi are based on its erroneous construction of the term material consisting essentially of a dilatant compound. Material consisting essentially of is a partially open transition phrase that should be construed to require the listed material, in this case a dilatant compound, and materials that do not affect the basic and novel properties. The essential properties of a dilatant compound are set out by the board's construction of that term. Those properties are soft and pliable under slow loading and elastic and bouncy under rapid loading.
One of your arguments is that the board's construction includes materials that were disavowed during prosecution, correct?
Yes.
Show me where that material was disavowed during prosecution.
It's in the prosecution history, I believe, if I could just a second, at appendix page 958.
Do you want to identify for us, are you going to identify us the specific sentences that you're relying on?
Yes, I will. Okay. The background of this is that they originally tried to distinguish it using formulations. They were told they couldn't based on 112. So they removed from the claims the limitations directed to the formulation, and they argued that they were disavowing the Rhodes material. They were distinguishing the Rhodes reference material based on its maximizing energy return.
Can you show me where I can see a clear and unmistakable disavow?
On appendix page 958, in the section under two small eyes, near the top of the page, one, two, three, five down, the statement is made, on the other hand, applicant teaches the maximization of energy returning depending on the load for the purpose of maximizing running speed, that is faster running for more energy return, which in turn enables faster running. As opposed to, at the beginning, it says also Rhodes teaches the Rhodes medium must contain fiber filler to stabilize the composition so its static viscosity is high and expressly to minimize the inherent energy return of the dilatant compound. Now, to return to your question, we are not arguing that this is a disavowal because we believe a disavowal would be to narrow the claim in a way that it wasn't narrowed by prosecution. by the meaning of the claim, by ordinary construction.
Fair enough. You can go on to another argument.
Returning to construction of material consisting essentially of a dilatant compound, the board ignored the properties of a dilatant compound, as the board had construed that term, to construe material consisting essentially of a dilatant compound to be materials whose formulation contains substances that are not dilatant so long as those other substances do not render the material non-dilatant as a whole. The board did not explain what non-dilatant as a whole means and did not explain why it adopted that construction. The board's construction is error, we believe, because it does not incorporate the properties of a dilatant compound. Mr. Townsend's proposed construction, on the other hand, requires a dilatant compound and other materials that do not significantly diminish energy returned by the dilatant compound under rapid loading.
I'm having a little bit of a hard time understanding the difference between your proposed construction and the board's. With regard to Izumi, I'm failing to see why your changed construction, which only slightly differs from the board's, makes any difference. Could you explain that to me?
Well, I think it's very different than what the board said, because our construction begins by saying a dilatant compound, which is what it's a material consisting essentially of a dilatant compound. So we have a dilatant compound plus other components, so long as they don't materially affect the dilatant compound in a way relevant to the invention.
Your view is that Izumi doesn't disclose a dilatant compound?
As construed, no. And we believe that's the reason that the board rejected anticipation by Izumi, which was ground one.
I thought that the dilatant compound simply was a polymeric material that changes from soft and pliable under slow application of a load to elastic and bouncy under rapid application of a load. If you look at Izumi, it does disclose a putty that has that characteristic.
I agree with half of that. I agree that under slow application of loading, the Izumi material is not significantly different in a relevant way from the dilatant compound that is the dilatant compound claimed for the 416 patent. On the other hand, under rapid loading, we think is very different. This was the basis of the argument before the board on the anticipation ground. And the difference is that rather than behaving elastically, in other words, like a spring, you can compress it and it springs back, that's the dilatant compound that we are claiming in the 416 patent. It's elastic and bouncy. Izumi, on the other hand, is directed to stability. In other words, under very fast loading, the midsole in particular, doesn't compress because it's supported. And that's a different behavior than the behavior under rapid loading of the dilatant compound. This was addressed in more specificity with respect to the anticipation ground, of course. These polymeric materials are formulated. It falls within the area of polymer viscoelasticity and polymer rheology. In material scientists, such as the expert that supported Mr. Townsend before the board, work in this area, and they formulate materials specific to have specific behaviors. In this case, the Izumi has one behavior under rapid loading, and the 416 patent behavior has a different behavior.
Okay, you're into your rebuttal time. Do you want to reserve that, or you can continue on if you like?
I guess I would just... If I may, I'd just like to address the claim construction issue that's relevant to the other obviousness ground that's at issue here, and that is the obviousness over rooting and plant. The board's decision on that ground is directed to an erroneous construction of the limitation, a cavity formed in said top surface of a midsole. The board construed that limitation as a space within the midsole that may or may not open to the top surface of the midsole. The board did not explain how a cavity that does not open to the top surface of the midsole could be formed in said top surface, or why it adopted that construction. The board's That the board's construction is error because it is not limited as the plain language of the claim requires. The board's construction is also error because it does not require the cavity to open only to the top surface.
Why does it have to open only to the top surface? I see your argument with respect to the other part of the claim construction, but I don't know why it's proper to read the word only into this claim term.
There are two bases for that, we believe, Your Honor. One is that the appropriate definition of a cavity is being in space that's within the body. If it's within the body, it would be entirely within the body, we believe. The other reason is that it is the way...
Couldn't it be within the body but have an opening like two places?
Potentially, yes, but that's where the specification of the 416 patent comes in. I'm referring now to appendix page 96, and this is at column 5, lines 35 through 41, which say that under slow loading, this material behaves like a putty. If it was on a table in front of us and we pushed it, it would just become a pancake. That wouldn't be good in the sole of a shoe. And so what stops that from happening is the fact that the surrounding midsole now supports it. It's trying to flow, it's trying to go away, but the midsole stops it. We believe that's what is described at this point in the 416 patent. And that's the reason that another hole, you know, an exit out of the cavity for the material would prevent that transfer of load to the midsole, which is an essential part. It's half of the improvement in the invention. In other words, it's the cushioning of the midsole that's holding the slowly loaded, the latent compound from moving, from leaving the cavity.
So your view is that we have to read the word only in there because otherwise the invention won't work? Is that what I hear you to be
saying? It won't work as described, no.
But will it work as claimed? I mean, claims don't have to be perfect, and there is no language of only in the claim.
Well, we rely on the definition of cavity for that, and we think that's consistent with both the disclosure of the by the 416 patent, and in particular this disclosure of how the midsole and this material work together under slow loading.
Mr. Donnelly?
May I proceed?
Yes, you may proceed, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Darren Donnelly, and I represent Brooks Sports. Before responding to some of the arguments my opponent made, because there are so many issues and I won't be able to address all of them, I'd like to make a few general comments about the issues in the proceedings below. First, because the board found the challenge claims unpatentable both on the grounds based on Izumi and Rudy and Plant, my opponent needs to show error on both those grounds in order to call into question the decision below. Second, to provide a little context for the issues here from what happened below, on the Izumi grounds, it was a classic battle of the experts. The board below credited Brooks' expert, Dr. Shorten, made factual findings consistent with Dr. Shorten's opinions, and that largely determined the outcome of the Izumi part of the case. On Rudy and Plant, there wasn't a battle of the expert at all because Townsend did not put in any expert evidence on the Rudy-Plant combination. So when the board made factual findings and credited parts of the record from Brooks, there was no competing expert testimony for the board to possibly adopt. On the claim construction issues, on the Izumi side, the board below, as Your Honors observed, rejected Townsend's argument that the claim language material consisting essentially of a dilatant compound, we shorthanded as the material term, should not have a limitation read into it, do not significantly diminish energy storage and return at high rates of loading. And on the Rudy and Plant side, whether the term cavity forming the top surface of the midsole only opens to the top surface of the midsole. Those two issues make it up here today, as well as a couple new issues on appeal, and I'll talk about those. Finally, Brooks raised an anticipation argument below that the board rejected. That anticipation argument was based on the contention from Brooks that a person of ordinary skill in the art would understand Izumi's bouncing putty to refer to silly putty or its generic equivalent, Dow.
Why did the board say that those claims were not anticipated by Izumi? And I notice you're not challenging that today.
Well, right.
So we just have to assume that whatever the board said is true. I mean, right?
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
So could you just tell me why it is that Izumi was found to not anticipate? What was the missing limitation?
Yeah, and just to be clear, right, as we understand this court's precedent, we did not have grounds to cross-appeal that issue. And if we did, we would have. I don't think...
Okay, that's fine.
Why don't you let him argue in the alternative for affirmance, couldn't you?
We certainly could have, given the dozens of issues in the briefing. One additional one did not...
So we need to accept that fact-finding is true, but what is the fact-finding? Izumi doesn't teach what? That it doesn't teach a dilatant compound? Or
no.
A material consisting essentially of a dilatant compound?
No.
What is it?
Right. I think the board's fact-finding is that, well, I'd characterize it differently. I think the board didn't like the way we cast the anticipation argument. And what I mean by that is our anticipation argument has two parts to it. One, we argued that a person of skill in the art would understand Izumi's bouncing putty to refer to silly putty. We argued silly putty is an embodiment of the claims of the claim one of the 416 patent, and just kind of, you know, transitivity. Bouncing putty suggests silly putty. Silly putty's an embodiment.
Can I ask you a question? On page 834 of the board's decision, it says, we also find that Izumi does not disclose expressly that its silicone bouncing putty is or must be necessarily a dilatant compound. Is that the finding?
Is it 34?
Yes. I think that's the finding that we're going to start with for obviousness, right? This is on the anticipation section.
Yeah. So if I can explain a bit how we got here and what I think this statement means is I don't think it adds anything to what came before for the reasons I'll go into. So what the anticipation ground was first, this argument based on just basically the line.
I want to just make sure you're using your time. What my question is, given this sentence and this finding by the board, I just want to make sure, nonetheless, the board made, is there substantial evidence to support the board's finding that nonetheless, Izumi renders the claim obvious?
Yes, there is.
Okay.
So the board made specific factual findings that the dilatant compound in Izumi has similar properties to the bouncing putty in Izumi has similar properties to the dilatant compound that is present in the 416 patent. It made specific findings that the composition of Izumi's bouncing putty is similar to the composition of what is taught in the 416 patent within the scope of the claims. And in its obviousness analysis, sort of combines those specific findings to show that Izumi's bouncing putty meets each and every element of the claim as the board construed the claim. And so what I think the anticipation section here really says is the board didn't agree with Brooks's contention that silly putty was called to mind by reference to bouncing putty in Izumi in an express sense. It did not find express disclosure of silly putty. And then Brooks also argued, based on the description of the chemical formulation of the material in Izumi and the chemical formulation that's described in the 416 patent about the Dow compound, that a person of skill would have understood the reference to that chemical formulation of Izumi's bouncing putty to suggest or teach the Dow 3179 compound. The board said we didn't find that expressly in Izumi. And then the board in the paragraph you were looking at, Your Honor, sort of addresses the third paragraph in Brooks' anticipation argument. And we made this one argument based on the language that bouncing putty and silly putty are kind of terms used to refer to the same thing. The board didn't agree that there was express disclosure of silly putty. We make this argument that the chemical formulations are similar. The board said, I didn't find express disclosure of Dow 3179 in Izumi. And then we make an argument that there are similar properties between the two compounds. And this paragraph is saying, even if I agree with you, Brooks, that there are similar properties and compositions, it doesn't change my mind that there's not express disclosure of silly putty.
It's expressly. Right.
Pardon me?
You're focusing on the word use of the phrase expressly by the board.
Yeah, right. I think the board effectively used an ipsissimis is verbis or in hac verba language or mindset on anticipation.
And then when it turned to obviousness, it said one of ordinary skill would have known that the goal was to exhibit the properties of a dilating compound.
Right. The board made those factual findings, and I think the board in its anticipation section was saying we were not persuaded by your anticipation argument as you framed it, Brooks. But when we get to obviousness, we've got clear factual support from Dr. Shorten and my opponent's expert, Dr. McKinley, that show that the properties of Izumi's bouncing putty are similar to those that of the claim material. The composition of Izumi's bouncing putty is similar to the composition of the claim material. The board's construction shows that with those factual findings, all the elements of the construction are present. There is a material that behaves as a dilatant compound, has similar properties. There is material that is added filler, but overall it still maintains those similar properties. Overall, Izumi's bouncing putty acts as a dilatant compound. There is the finding based on Professor McKinley's declaration that the reaction product in Izumi is dilatant at high speeds. And with those factual findings, the board's obviousness conclusion follows from a straightforward application of those findings to its claim construction. Let me address briefly the argument my friend made about the claim construction issues regarding the term consisting essentially of a dilatant compound and cavity. Portion of the prosecution history my friend pointed you to, that was a reference to the teachings of the subject application. There's a contrast of what applicant teaches. There's no description of what applicant claimed. There's no discussion of the invention as a whole. That paragraph doesn't rise to the level of a disclaimer under this court's jurisprudence as to what is required to be a clear disavowal of claims. And whether or not they want to call it a disclaimer or something else, ultimately it is an attempt to read the limitation in from the prosecution history as disavowing what would otherwise be scope within the claim, and the prosecution history doesn't support that. And the language after that portion of the specification that my friend quoted provides a different rationale for why the claim was patentable. And it is that invention as a whole, its claimed structural combination with filler located in particular portions, and that's an argument that shows up elsewhere in the prosecution history. We cite it in our papers, and it is a different argument for patentability than what my friend argues was the supposed disavowal that led to allowance. On the claim construction issue related to cavity, I wanted to spend a little time to make clear that there's two issues. One, which the court observed, whether cavity needs to only open to the top surface, the midsole. The board found below that the ordinary meaning of that did not require it in addition to the specification, and there was no reference or no reliance on the prosecution history. But I wanted to be very clear that the other aspect of that construction, this may or may not open, is completely irrelevant. There's no item of prior art that doesn't open to the top surface of the midsole. Brooks made no argument about the interpretation of this below. All of our prior art opened to the top surface of the midsole.
And but, your view is it doesn't matter if it opens to the top surface as well as another surface.
Well, there's an argument about may or may not open to the top surface. Right? We don't think it matters whether or not it doesn't open the top surface. All of our prior art opens to the top surface. So if the board's construction had some issue with not open to the top surface, there's no way that can change the outcome.
You're saying that's harmless error. But what about the argument that it shouldn't open to, it should only open to the top surface?
Yeah, we disagreed with that. We disagreed with that below. And the argument that my friend made pointing to specific parts of the specification, that one, doesn't rise to a disavowal from the specification under this court's case law. And if you look at figure four of the Reedy patent, which is at APPX 740, right, the Reedy patent shows Rudy's device when it is being scrushed, you know, when someone's, I see him in red, may I complete?
You can finish that thought.
Yep. Rudy's device, right, Rudy is a Nike Air. Rudy is sort of the father of Nike Air. And that picture shows someone stepping on a rock. And the Nike Air, right, the air doesn't blow out of the shoe. It is contained in the shell. So this notion that it would be impossible to control and prevent the invention from working, it's just inconsistent with how people in the art understand how this technology works. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Hampton, you have 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. To begin briefly with the rejection of anticipation by the board, there are actually two places in the decision that I think are relevant. One is at APPX 34, which you discussed with Mr. Donnelly, and the other place is at APPX 79, which is the rehearing decision. And what happened there was that the board did not reach a ground that was asserted, but that ground relied on Izumi for disclosing material consisting essentially of a latent compound. And on rehearing, the board rejected that ground specifically because, as it sets out on page APPX 79, they had found that Izumi does not disclose material consisting essentially of a latent compound. There are many errors, we believe, in the way the board addressed obviousness in both cases. We don't believe Mr. Donnelly talked a great deal about similarities between the Izumi material and the 416, the latent compound. But obviousness is not based on similarities. Obviousness is based on differences. And the board never identified the differences between the Dalayton compound disclosed by the 416 patent and the silicone bouncing putty disclosed by Izumi, even though that was certainly an issue that was presented to them. Therefore, the board had no idea how, under the board's analysis, you wouldn't know how to modify the Izumi material to make it the 416 material because you wouldn't know how it was different. And if you didn't know how to modify it, you couldn't find a motivation to modify, and the board didn't in any case in this here. With respect to a lot of the record below, this is not an appeal of the record below. This is an appeal of the decision of the board. And as the court made clear in the Alacrotech versus Intel case, if the record below that was submitted by the parties is part of the decision, the board has to adopt that and state reasons for adopting that record. And the board did not do that in this case. And I guess I'd just like to finish with sort of the last issue that was presented by the briefing, and that is the board's decision to disregard testimony by Brooks' expert that he failed to make a shoe as Mr. Townsend had disclosed it. And the board disregarded that testimony in the final written decision. We asked on rehearing for the board to reconsider and explain it. The board's response was that there was a conflict between the expert testimony on which we relied and later expert testimony, and that resolving that conflict was, and that the board resolved that conflict by disregarding the testimony on which we relied. But the board didn't identify the conflict, and the board didn't explain why it resolved the conflict in the way it did. So we believe that the board should have done both. And to just to point out that even Brooks's briefing points out that there's not necessarily a conflict between those two groups of testimony. I yield the rest of my time.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.